from the White House got in touch with Daley. If the current president were to board Air Force One and fly to Chicago at that instant, would there be enough support to give him the nomination he'd declined to pursue 4 months earlier? Daley said yes. He promised Johnson he could get the delegates. But just as the president was considering such a dramatic turn of events, his Secret Service detail told him it wouldn't be possible. There was no way they could ensure his safe passage to the amphitheater. In the end, Johnson decided against it. The possibility of yet another disastrous assassination, his own, would be too much for the country to handle. At around 10 p.m., Senator Abraham Ribicoff, the former governor of Connecticut, approached the podium. He was 57 years old. He wore a slim black tie and dark suit. When he spoke, the pointer finger of his right hand chopped down at the air in front of him. That week, he'd written a nominating speech for George McGovern, the South Dakotan who'd been a late anti-war entry into the race. But after what had happened at the Hilton, he couldn't stay silent. "As I look to the confusion in this hall," he said, "and watch on television the turmoil and violence that is competing with this great convention for the attention of the American people, there is something else in my heart tonight, and not the speech that I prepared to give." Daley watched in disbelief, a lidless, fisheye glare. "And with George McGovern as President of the United States," Ribicoff continued, "we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. With George McGovern, we wouldn't have the National Guard." The crowd erupted. Chairman Albert smacked his gavel. Richard Daley, standing up straight now, cupped his hand to his mouth like a megaphone. "Fuck you," he screamed toward the podium. "You Jew son of a bitch, you lousy motherfucker, go home." Everyone else in the vicinity could hear, including Ribicoff, who nodded slowly. "How hard it is," he said. "How hard it is. How hard it is to accept the truth." Thompson watched from the balcony. When the convention was over, he'd write in a letter to Ribicoff, whom he'd never met, "Everything you did that night seemed to rest on a bedrock of human decency. There was an awesome dignity in your handling of Daley and his thugs, and for a moment that whole evil scene was redeemed. But only for a moment." It was unprecedented. A senator had just accused the head of his party's elaborate machine on national television of using government-directed violence to silence dissent, punish rivals, and prevent the press from publicizing what was really going on. Ribicoff had called out Daley's tactics for what they were. During the convention, you had a hodgepodge of local and federal authorities loosely associated around a single issue, the country's militaristic campaign in Vietnam. And when one of these factions had turned out to be willing to go so far as to beat the anti-war opponents they at the time all shared, the others, including the current president of the United States, his chosen successor, and the recently nominated Republican rival, justified this violence by explaining it away with hollow catch-alls like nationalism and patriotism and weakness. As in, these protesters were really just a bunch of plotting communist outsiders who deserved what they got because they were too contemptibly weak to back up their chants and speeches in the street fight they'd brought on themselves. The city of Chicago and the people of Chicago didn't do a thing that was wrong, Hubert Humphreys said afterward. There are certain people in the United States who feel that all you have to do is riot and you can get your way. I have not time for that. That night, just after 11 p.m., it became official. With Pennsylvania, Humphreys' delegate count finally broke the threshold. The nomination was his on the first ballot. He'd represent the Democratic Party against Richard Nixon in the general election. The next day, during his acceptance speech, he'd find it appropriate to quote St. Francis of Assisi, "Where there is hatred, let me sow love." Afterward, now it was Thursday afternoon, the last of the convention, Hunter Thompson was kicked out of the amphitheater by Mayor Daley's security agents, who appeared to be escorting away any and all members of the press, regardless of their behavior or political bent, without explanation. He spent the rest of the night wandering the city, drinking and writing, unable to sleep. Whenever he tried to explain what he'd seen, he broke down crying. At sunrise on Friday morning, on his way back from a Ramparts magazine party, he was crossing to his hotel from Grant Park when out in front of the Hilton he came upon Blair Clark, Senator Gene McCarthy's campaign manager and the former vice president of CBS News. Clark was pacing up and down the sidewalk. His eyes, Thompson noticed, were shining with tears. Inside the lobby, people were running and screaming and holding on to one another. Some appeared to be bleeding profusely. Thompson tried to find out what had happened. Only a few minutes earlier, dozens of police, accompanied by members of the National Guard, had stormed the operations suite of the McCarthy campaign on the 15th floor. And with their billy clubs, they'd beat the young staffers who'd been volunteering for the campaign since New Hampshire. The police would later claim they were pelted by debris thrown from McCarthy's headquarters. But that was impossible. The windows to the suite had been shut and locked for hours. Richard Goodwin happened to be in the room when the violence broke out. He'd stopped to say goodbye. And as everyone was being herded downstairs in the lobby for arrest, he sent a message to McCarthy to gather up his Secret Service detail and come immediately. The senator promptly arrived with his suit-wearing agents and demanded to know who was in charge. But the cops and guardsmen shrugged. Together, they melted away, back out onto the street. "Just what I thought," McCarthy called out after them. "Nobody's in charge." By now, the sun was coming up over the lake. It was Friday morning, August 30. The tail end of the very worst political convention in American history. Hunter Thompson stood there in the Hilton lobby, watching its final bloody act, the curtain falling as a recent presidential candidate and his Secret Service detail faced off against the combined members of the National Guard and the Chicago Police, whose victims lay wailing and bleeding on the lobby floor. How could America continue to exist in the manner it was once conceived, if its mechanisms could be appropriated so easily, in the name of everything the Republic was meant to stand against? It was the ultimate horror, Thompson described afterward in a letter to a friend. The final groin shot that only a beast like Daley would stoop to deliver. It was an LBJ-style trick. No rest for the losers. Keep them on the run. And if they fall, kick the shit out of them. Chapter 4. Freak Kingdom in the Rockies, 1969 to 1970. A king hell bummer in almost every way. On Monday, January 20, 1969, beneath a low Atlantic sky the color of wet concrete, Richard Milhouse Nixon descended the steps at the Capitol's East Portico and repeated back the oath administered to him by Chief Justice Earl Warren, taking office as the 37th President of the United States. "The greatest honor history can bestow is the title of peacemaker," he proclaimed in his address. "When we listen to the better angels of our nature, we find that they celebrate the simple things, the basic things, such as goodness, decency, love, kindness." Hunter Thompson had made the trip east from Colorado to cover the inauguration. Bill Cardoso, whom he'd met during the New Hampshire primary, was now an editor for the Boston Globe's Weekend magazine. And he'd commissioned Thompson to write a freewheeling feature on the festivities, going so far as to secure a press pass from the newspaper's political bureau. "The peace we seek to win is not victory over any other people, but the peace that comes with healing in its wings," Nixon said now. As our eyes catch the dimness of the first rays of dawn, let us not curse the remaining dark. Let us gather the light. Immediately, Thompson recognized the source of the overwrought rhetoric. Ray Price, the administrator's chief speechwriter who'd helped spearhead during the campaign the rebranding effort that had sought to repackage Nixon as the patriotic, stabilizing unifier America so desperately needed. Not that such a feat would have been possible without this specific candidate's unique mutability. Still, in victory, Richard Nixon had proven that he could become anything, including, against all odds, the unquestioned leader of the free world. "I went to Washington for his inauguration," Thompson would write, "hoping for a terrible shit rain that would pound the White House to splinters. But it didn't happen. No shit rain, no justice, and Nixon was finally in charge." In retrospect, however, the true extent of Richard Nixon's amorality would turn out to be far more drastic than anyone at the time could prove, something that's only recently come to light, almost half a century later. In the months that followed the August convention in Chicago, Richard Nixon had enjoyed a double-digit lead over his Democratic rival, Hubert Horatio Humphrey. But on October 31, 1968, just a week before the election, Lyndon Johnson went on national television and announced a halt to the bombing of North Vietnam, effective immediately, as a final attempt to secure a negotiated peace with the communist regime in Hanoi. All the involved parties, including the Soviets, appeared to be on board. The settlement would establish a coalition government between the South Vietnamese and the Viet Cong in Saigon, an approach that both Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy had advocated, and that Johnson was only now willing to embrace for a variety of reasons, not least of which was the increasingly likely defeat of Humphrey's candidacy. "We have the best deal we now can get," Johnson's national security advisor, Walt Rostow, informed him. "Vastly better than any we thought we could get in 1961. Nixon, tipped off to the development by a sympathetic participant in the negotiating process, knew that such a settlement might cost him the election. "Events could cut down a lead as big as ours," he'd said about a possible end to the war in Vietnam. He wasn't wrong. Overnight, Humphrey's poll numbers shot up. Suddenly, Nixon was faced with the very real prospect of defeat. In response, with the help of senior campaign advisors John Mitchell and H.R. Haldeman, he orchestrated a back-channel message to the current leader of the regime in Saigon, President Nguyen Thieu, communicating through intermediaries that it would be in the South's best interest if he won the election. With a stout anti-communist Republican like Nixon in the White House to drive a harder bargain at the negotiating table, Saigon would get a much better deal in future peace talks. This was, at the very least, a felony offense. Private citizens are forbidden by federal law to interfere with negotiations between governments. But in reality, the consequences were much starker. He'd betrayed the interests of his country in order to serve his own. And it had worked. Thieu delayed, refusing at the last moment to commit to the talks. Lyndon Johnson was incensed. Already he discovered the real reason for Thieu's astonishing recalcitrance, through information gathered from a CIA listening device that had been placed in the South Vietnamese presidential office, as well as an FBI wiretap on Saigon's phone lines to their embassy in Washington. Johnson could prove that the Nixon campaign was attempting to sabotage the peace talks. "This is treason," he told the Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen, an old friend, on November 2. "They're contacting a foreign power in the middle of a war." The next day, Nixon, who'd by now caught wind of the fallout — Johnson was considering going public with the information — decided it was time to give LBJ a call. "Ah, Mr. President, this is Dick Nixon," he said. "Yes, Dick. Nixon stammered. Any rumblings about, someone trying to sabotage the Saigon government's attitude certainly has absolutely no credibility as far as I'm concerned. I'm very happy to hear that, Dick, Johnson replied, knowing full well that what he'd just heard was a lie. Because that is taking place. My God, Nixon exclaimed, his words breathy and melodramatic. I would never do anything to encourage Saigon not to come to the table. What could Lyndon Johnson do? After years of telling the public the opposite of what was actually going on in Southeast Asia, he'd lost all credibility. If he accused Nixon, he'd have to reveal the methods by which he'd gathered the information, spying on American citizens and on an allied government. In the end, he decided it would be too risky. The peace process never got back on track for Johnson. Over the next 2 days, Nixon's campaign wrote off the bombing halt as a desperate last-ditch effort to save Humphrey. And on November 5, Nixon took the Electoral College, pulling out the popular vote by 0.5%. He had committed treason in a desperate attempt to secure the presidency, and no one had stopped him. At last, he'd won. From the moment he began his term, he was unthinkably compromised, and the only way to protect himself from exposure would be to rely on the same crooked impulses that had gotten him into this situation in the first place, which meant that from here on out, the shape-shifting capacity that had carried him so unbelievably far, his greatest political skill, would be unavailable to him. He was locked into place once and for all by the extreme actions he'd pushed himself to take. To survive the next 8 years, this latest mutation into a traitorous, treasonous beast of a man would have to be his last. It was the version that Hunter Thompson had sensed from the start. 35,000 Americans had already died in the war Nixon had just interfered to extend. More than 20,000 would perish in the next 7 years, a number that gets at the real horror of what it means for someone so deeply self-serving to assume control of the American government. Because of the nature of the presidency in the context of the post-war world, Richard Nixon now held the power of life and death over every single one of his citizens, a human currency he was clearly willing to cash in if it might personally benefit him. For its part, Nixon said at the end of his address, government will listen. We will strive to listen in new ways. And then he got into his enormous bulletproof Lincoln limousine and kicked off the day's inaugural parade, which, in its route from the Capitol to the White House, would take him within a literal stone's throw of the thousands of protesters who now lined the city's winter streets. Hunter Thompson, thanks to his press credentials, was able to stake out a prime spot at the end of the parade route, the corner of Pennsylvania and 15th Street, across from the large stand of bleachers, the intersection where the president's vanguard would make its penultimate turn before passing into the vast security cordon of the White House. It was early afternoon. The wind had come down from the northeast, freezing and brittle, knocking at everyone's hats and handbills and high-collared coats. Nixon's motorcade advanced directly into its teeth, up the city's long, angled corridor, Pennsylvania Avenue, a diagonal that connected one seat of American power to another. The procession was led by a wedge of 30 police motorcycles. Secret Service agents trotted alongside. The protesters had been posted up along the parade route at 3 main locations. Throughout the weekend, they'd been gathering for what was being called the counter-inaugural, a multi-day event organized by the same activists from the Democratic National Convention, including MOB leader David Dellinger and Yippie founder Jerry Rubin, who together, on account of Mayor Daley's wrath, were facing 5-year prison sentences in Illinois on trumped-up conspiracy to riot charges. After Chicago, the mood of the general anti-war movement had soured. Violence and confrontation are the themes now, Thompson would write in his Globe feature, which would be published 3 days later. Vicious dissidence is the style. As the motorcade approached the intersection of 12th Street and Pennsylvania, the site of the old post office and clock tower, the first small group was waiting. They were flanked, front and back, by Navy-jacketed D.C. police and National Guardsmen, as well as an additional unarmed contingent from the Army's 82nd Airborne Division. Not that it mattered. As soon as the limousine appeared, they unleashed a dense hail of rocks and sticks. Members of the Secret Service walking alongside struggled to bat down the projectiles. Someone lofted a softball-sized wad of tinfoil that, in its precipitous arc, appeared to be falling directly toward the vehicle carrying Mr. and Mrs. Nixon, which accelerated, jolting its occupants and forcing the agents on the street into an accompanying run. The next set of protesters, the largest, had gathered at 14th Street near the National Theater on the north side of Pennsylvania, the parade route's widest spot. Here, more than 1,000 young men and women chanted slogans at the motorcade. 4 more years of death! Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, NLF is gonna win! 2, 4, 6, 8, organize to smash the state! And 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your fucking war! From the crowd came a new barrage. A paint-filled Christmas ornament shattered against the pavement. A smoking can was tossed just ahead of the presidential limousine, rolling underneath. National Guardsmen and D.C. police surged against the crowd, reaching for the assailants. But the protesters grabbed and beat anyone from law enforcement unlucky enough to venture too far into their midst. One cop, after charging into the crowd, had been nearly stripped naked, and as a result, the hail kept coming down. They threw stones, bottles, cans, firecrackers, and smoke bombs. They threw pennies and pebbles. They threw table forks and a spoon. They threw tomatoes. They threw manure. They lit on fire the miniature American flags that Boy Scouts had been passing out and threw them as hard as they could in the general direction of the new president. It was 2:45 p.m. Hunter Thompson was still in his spot at Pennsylvania and 15th Street. Across the avenue, in the white plank bleachers, where mob leaders had legitimately purchased 200 tickets, protesters were holding up signs with messages like, "Stop the war against Black America," and "Nixon is the one, the number one war criminal." They waved Viet Cong banners. They passed around a blotchy dark sack they kept calling the Black Flag of Anarchy. Someone threw a half-gallon jug of wine. Standing alongside Thompson, a newscaster from CBS announced into his microphone, "Here comes the president." From around the corner, the limousine appeared, a sort of huge, hollowed-out cannonball on wheels. Thompson would write, "A very nasty-looking armored car. There was a stench of bedrock finality about it." It had been a year of assassinations and police riots and internecine defeats that had led, in the end, to the most unthinkable outcome of all: Richard Nixon's victory march to the White House lawn. The whole concept of peaceful protest died at the Democratic convention. Thompson wrote that night for his Boston Globe piece. Up until Chicago, there'd been the assumption, however far-fetched, that the politicians running the country were capable of perceiving a mass demonstration on something like the war in Vietnam within the context of America's general political reality. That they were listening, were willing to play by the same set of guidelines the Republic had agreed upon almost 2 centuries earlier, even if they vehemently disagreed with what they heard. The 1960s were full of examples of good, powerful men changing their minds on heavy issues, Thompson would write years later. The pinnacle being Lyndon Johnson's shocking decision to recognize his failure in Vietnam and preemptively forego a second term, which was why the current reality felt so devastating. With Agnew and Nixon and Mitchell coming into power, he'd explain, there was simply no point in yelling at the fuckers. They were born deaf and stupid. He'd realized that it no longer mattered how effectively you conducted a demonstration. The people you were hoping to reach were incapable of hearing what you had to say. The presidential limousine continued past Thompson. He watched it turn from 15th Street to the White House and then disappear behind a wall of black, leafless trees. The temperature was dropping. The sky thickened and dimmed. Now the protesters were fighting among themselves. Police rode by on horseback. The wind lifted and let fall the parade's long ribbon of debris. Overhead, an enormous helicopter beat the air. The city smelled the way it always does in winter, like dust and freezing rain and shallow, stagnant water. Thompson zipped up his ski jacket and walked south toward the mall. Around him, the white sand statues and memorials revealed themselves as if haphazardly, like relics, their individual meaning suddenly subsumed beneath the thing the city had become, Mr. Nixon's city, a monument to the office he'd finally won, to him. From the mall, he could see Arlington National Cemetery, its vast hillside landscaped evenly with more graves than he could count. That was part of the monument, too, the worst part. Across the gray river, Bobby Kennedy lay closed in a coffin only a few feet off from that of his older brother, both of them forced now to adorn, in death, in silence, the sinister spectacle of the present. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing, Bobby said just before he was assassinated, a quote his brother had attributed to Edmund Burke. Thompson would never forget hearing this line. He'd hold it dear for the rest of his life, though on a day as haunted as this one, such wisdom could be heard to mean something different. It's only after the very best of us are driven into silence that the most destructive characteristics in our nature find the means to flourish. And suddenly Hunter Thompson felt disgusted and bone-chilled and at a loss. Overhead, the sky was about to break. He walked back to his hotel in the wind. What a fantastic monument to all the best instincts of the human race this country might have been, he'd later write. If we could have kept it out of the hands of greedy little hustlers like Richard Nixon. A few weeks after the inauguration, Thompson traveled to Edwards Air Force Base in California to write about its test pilot program for pageant, a lucrative assignment. Afterward, after peppering career officers with questions on Vietnam as he watched SR-71 reconnaissance jets scream across the desert sky, he checked into the Hyatt Continental Hotel on LA's Sunset Strip, where he planned to finish a draft of the article. Each day, he also drove out to East Los Angeles, and in the company of Oscar Acosta, he was offered a glimpse into the dynamic Chicano movement, a subject he was considering for his Death of the American Dream project. By this point, Acosta had been practicing law in Southern California for just over a year. Already, he'd become one of the most well-known attorneys in the state. For his first major case, he defended a group of high school students and teachers who'd organized a citywide walkout to protest the underfunded educational system in East LA. The police had physically attacked these students and then charged them afterward with conspiracy, a felony, even though the thing they were accused of plotting, disturbing the peace, was only a misdemeanor. It was an outrageous escalation on law enforcement's behalf. If convicted, the defendants faced up to 40 years in prison. But Acosta would get all the charges against them dismissed. To do so, he employed a three-pronged argument, claiming, 1, a lack of evidence, 2, the violation of the defendant's First Amendment right to freedom of speech, and 3, discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment based on the fact that the grand jury used to indict them lacked representation from the Mexican-American community. Since joining the movement, Acosta had come to understand that, in the face of widespread institutional racism, everything is political. And in the courtroom, he refused to separate his partisan arguments from his legal ones, as he'd been taught to do in law school. As a result, his unorthodox tactics were shining a huge amount of unwanted attention on police practices. At press conferences in front of the courthouse, he'd recount the stories of Chicano youths who died without explanation in police custody. He was regularly held in contempt and jailed for days at a time. Once, in court proceedings, he took an unloaded gun from the evidence display and waved it at members of the jury, ordering everyone to get on the ground, and then he proceeded to ask them in a normal tone of voice if, under such intimidation, they should be expected to give an accurate testimony of events, in the way his own clients were. But his real activism was only getting started. For his next move, he was preparing to attack the legal validity of the grand jury system itself. At that time, in L.A. County, grand juries were appointed by circuit court magistrates, who were almost always white. Acosta's plan was to subpoena all the judges in the area and interrogate them as to their relationships with and prejudices toward members of the Mexican-American community. During his first few nights in town, when Thompson was supposed to be writing the pageant article, he and Acosta hit the Sunset Strip. Over drinks, they continued the political discussion they'd started in Aspen. Whether it was still possible, in the context of a year like 1968, to improve the American system from within, or if it was finally time to tear the whole thing down and start again. Acosta's recent legal success had exposed him to the full scrutiny of his very powerful enemies. "Not only are my telephones bugged," he'd recently confided, "but the district attorney here in Los Angeles is out to get me." Like Thompson, he also took a large daily dosage of amphetamine. His chosen variety was Benzedrine. And that February, along the West Hollywood Street's famous Rainy Rise, they closed out Whiskey A Go-Go and worked their way back to the Hyatt Continental, the day coming up behind its cycle of low winter storms. Needless to say, by the end of the week, Hunter Thompson's article on the Air Force's test pilot program wasn't finished. It would eventually take him another month to complete a draft for submission. What's more, 8 hours before his flight back to Aspen, he found himself completely out of Dexedrine. "Getting toward dawn now," he wrote in his notebook. "Very foggy in the head. For the first time in at least 5 years, I am out of my little energy bombs." All he had left were 5 Ritalin pills. Useless at this point. Not strong enough. And a giant homemade capsule Acosta had given him that was equal parts amphetamine and mescaline. It's not as if a sudden burst of Dexedrine would have made much of a difference now. In the 2 years since Hell's Angels, he'd written hundreds of polished pages, some of his very best work, but almost all of it was on subjects that he found deeply compelling. When it came to an article he was only doing for the money, no amount of adrenaline and hard deadlines and Dexedrine could make up for his lack of personal attachment. "There is something perverse and even suicidal about speed," he'd written in his journal the year before. "Like the devil in Daniel Webster, buy high and sell low, ignoring that inevitable day when there's no more high except maybe a final freak out with cocaine, the certain knowledge of burning out a lot sooner than if I played it healthy." Now he was trapped in his Los Angeles hotel room with a limited number of hours until he needed to send off the article and check out. He felt panicked, and at that moment, what he wanted more than anything was to be free from these failures and deadlines and responsibilities altogether, or, failing that, to make them somehow irrelevant. "Well, I just swallowed the bugger," he wrote. "In this dead-tired, run-down condition, any reaction will be extreme. I've never had mescaline." Instead of working on the test pilot article, he spent the next 8 hours documenting on his typewriter his experiences. "The physical end of the thing is like the first half hour on acid," he wrote, "a sort of buzzing all over, and a sense of very pleasant physical paralysis, and the ball on this typewriter now appears to be made of arterial blood, and the cloud is off the sun again, for real this time, incredible light in the room, white blaze on the walls, glittering typewriter keys." As his departure time approached, he felt desperate for Aspen, for safety, for home. Finally, he called Acosta, who came by the hotel and helped him to the airport. "The drug is gone now," Thompson wrote from the plane. "Failing energy, disconnected thoughts, smelling of booze in this cabin. Nobody speaks. Fear and loathing, dizzy, flying and bouncing through the clouds. No more whole cards. Drained." During the fall and winter months that followed the Democratic convention, Thompson couldn't talk to Sandy about what he'd seen there without sobbing. "Hunter was a patriot," she'd later say. "He cared so much. He knew the Constitution. And then there he was in Chicago, and it's all being destroyed." Afterward, returning to Colorado, he began to look at Aspen and its local political system in a fresh way. How might this Western Valley be employed as a buffer against the mob-style violence he'd experienced? There was the region's natural isolation and also its small population, two factors that in the context of his evolving perspective on activism, politics is the art of controlling your environment, he realized after the police riot, spoke favorably to enacting change on a smaller scale, which at the moment looked a lot more viable than trying to get someone like Richard Nixon to acknowledge the legitimacy of your grievances. As such, it wasn't enough anymore to seclude himself here for most of the year with his family and then travel when necessary to report on the American political system. He also needed to make Aspen safe. In 1969, he and Peggy Clifford, now the top columnist for the Aspen Times, attended meetings for a neighborhood advocacy organization, the Citizens for Community Action, CCA, which, with its anti-sprawl and pro-environmental platform, was preparing to contest the key city and county positions up for election in the fall. He was introduced to James Salter, 10 years his senior, a novelist and screenwriter with a lyric style, who, after purchasing a house on the west side of town, had helped found the CCA. This valley was, after all, Thompson's home, the place where he and Sandy planned to spend the rest of their lives together. That winter, she was pregnant again. This time, there weren't any complications. Juan was 5. They were renting a large property on Little Woody Creek Road. It included a main house and another for guests, where their close friends Billy and Ann Noonan lived for a time. And in the aftermath of 1968, Thompson was ready to refocus his political effort toward the more immediate aspects of his life. That April, he received a welcome surprise in the mail from Bernard Shercliffe at Random House, $15,000 in royalties from Hell's Angels sales. He quickly worked out an arrangement with George Stranahan, his current landlord and friend, to purchase the houses he was renting, along with 25 acres of surrounding land. For the first time, he and Sandy would own their own place. He also sent money back to Louisville so his younger brother Jim, who was draft eligible, could make his tuition payments at the University of Kentucky. Sandy was due in mid-July. At the end of the spring, Thompson stopped traveling and returned to the seclusion of Owl Farm, the name he'd bestowed on the property, where, preparing for the baby, he could turn his attention to the Death of the American Dream book. Somehow, he hoped to put together a draft from the vivid fragments of political reporting he'd written over the last year, the latest being a commissioned piece for Esquire on the gun lobby. After Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr.'s murders, he'd found himself reevaluating his affinity for guns. The problem was that this latest feature had already ballooned to 140 pages, four times longer than what the magazine expected, with no clear end in sight. It was the same when it came to the Random House manuscript. I'm sitting here staring at about 400 pages of disconnected bullshit that may or may not boil into a book, he wrote Shercliffe in May. To Jim Silberman, he added, actually, I've been writing like a bastard the past 6 months. Which was true. The issue wasn't so much one of output, but organization. He still hadn't found the vehicle upon which he might lash his first-hand reportage on the shocking series of events that had unfolded across America the previous year. By June, it was clear. He'd miss his deadline. The material was in need of a more viable, self-contained structure. Still, 1969 was shaping up to be an enormous improvement over the year before. Even if he'd failed to meet his target date, he had a pile of pages waiting to be arranged. In Woody Creek, his new property was coming alive, a blooming alpine hillside. At any moment, the baby would arrive. The house cat and the family's new Doberman were also pregnant. I feel like Johnny Appleseed, Thompson wrote to Selma Shapiro. Dogs, cats, children, trees, grass, huge wooden structures, pottery, metal sculptures. I have a euphoric sense of building a dynasty of some kind. So maybe I should grow a beard along with all the rest. It was beautiful at Owl Farm, Sandy would later say. It was summertime, and there were lots of flowers. Everything just could not have been happier or more fertile and growing. Hunter was happy, and Juan was just this little tiger of a kid in a cowboy hat and cowboy boots, and he wore a little pistol.
Before the bomb and after. During the third week of July, amid the global drama of the Apollo 11 moonshot, Sandy went into labor. She and Thompson drove to Aspen Valley Hospital, located on the west side of town. It was a bright morning, rich and deeply green. Things progressed quickly. Thompson was in the delivery room with her when she gave birth. Suddenly, a baby girl, Sarah. Afterward, there was a terrible silence. The baby's face was blue. Now the doctor was whisking her away. Sandy refused to look. In the absence of the expected cries and congratulations, she couldn't bear to see what was happening. Thompson tried to reassure her. She's as big as a football player, he said. Outside, through the hospital's wide window, the broad West Aspen meadow was carpeted with wildflowers, a great inland sea of them. After Juan was born, the Thompsons had been told that because of their blood type's conflicting Rh factors, Sandy was Rh negative, the rarer of the two. The antibodies she'd naturally developed during subsequent births could result in hemolytic anemia, a condition in which the baby's red blood cells would be destroyed more quickly than they could be replicated. This was why their daughter's skin was blue. The antibodies that during the delivery had been transferred over were now disrupting her oxygen supply. At the time, the only effective treatment involved a transfusion of Rh immunoglobulin, which would target and destroy these antibodies. But in 1969, the Aspen Valley Hospital didn't carry the amount of blood necessary for the procedure. There was nothing they could do. The doctor came in. As soon as Sandy saw his face, she knew their daughter was dead. It was as if an enormous gate had been closed on her. I could just walk out of here, she said to her husband. She was watching the meadow through the window, its deep wildflower sea. Just walk out there, and then nothing is real.
And if it's not real, then my baby didn't die. With his gaze, Hunter Thompson worked to draw his wife's eyes back to his own. Sandy, he said, if you need to do that, if you need to go away, then you do that. But I just want you to know that Juan and I need you, and that we'll be glad when you come back. At last, she turned and looked. Suddenly, she could see him seeing her. His gaze was like a well-thrown anchor. I just switched, she'd later say. I came back. And to me, that was one of the most beautiful things Hunter has ever done. Afterward, as Sandy rested, Hunter Thompson screamed at the doctors and staff. What had they done with his daughter's body? Finally, he was told that it would be disposed of according to hospital regulations. Outside, against the hood of a car, he placed his head in his hands and wept. And then, with the help of his friend Billy Noonan, he went back into the hospital. Together, they located Sarah's body. He and Noonan drove down valley to a secluded bank of the Roaring Fork River. They dug a grave, and they buried the baby in a plot overlooking the water. For the rest of his life, Thompson would decline to discuss, let alone write about, what had happened. Nearly a month later, at 3 p.m. on September 10, 1969, the Austral Oil Company, working with the Atomic Energy Commission, in a joint effort to explore previously untapped reserves of natural gas, detonated a 40-kiloton fission bomb inside the Battlement Mesa near the small town of Rulison, just 40 miles due west of Aspen. About 50 protesters, many of them members of the local CCA, Hunter Thompson included, traveled to the blast site's observation post on the day of the explosion. Tom Benton, a talented Los Angeles artist who'd recently moved to the region, designed silkscreen posters for everyone to carry. Each featured a vivid, concentric target accompanied by the text, "Stop the blast, no contamination without representation." The bomb was lowered 8,442 feet underground. Upon ignition, it shattered the deep, gas-rich reef of sandstone and shale at the range's western base. The resulting shockwave lifted the surface of the mountain. The protesters, standing with the crowd of Austral oil workers, AEC representatives, and local dignitaries, swayed as if at sea. In the distance, the mesa's bluffs crumbled and smoked, a series of rock slides sending up dense gusts of dirt. Enormous boulders broke free, taking off topsoil and trees as they tumbled toward the Colorado River. Telephone cables were severed, chimneys collapsed. In nearby Grand Valley, bricks fell out of the walls of the post office. Across the region, the sound of the bomb resonated like a jet's, sonic and stark, a distinct, human-made thunder. "The oil companies and these fucking death bombs," Thompson wrote afterward. He and the protesters returned to Aspen, where they gathered that evening for a CCA event at the town's famous Humanistic Institute. The topic of discussion turned to the upcoming local elections. At the time, there were three pressing community issues: development, civil liberties, and the environment. Each opened onto the other. The local moguls, who in the 1950s had bought up large tracts of land, back when Aspen was still a secluded former mining town, were hell-bent on developing the area into an elite resort. Already, they were looking to sell their properties and erect new hotels and condominiums. As a result, the town's less affluent residents, a number of whom had ended up here from San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district, were deemed inimical to development. The council and magistrate enacted strict vagrancy laws, urging the sheriff, a humorless Oklahoman named Carol Whitmire, to charge and imprison the hippies flooding the town. What's more, the resort development had outpaced the community's environmental concerns. Questions of sustainability and growth and transportation and pollution and land use were dismissed by the members of the city council, a three-person board that basically ran things, in fear of hurting investment. At the end of the proceedings, CCA co-founder Robin Molney, a local architect who'd studied under Frank Lloyd Wright, claimed that in regards to the upcoming election, it would be better to forge a confederacy of neighborhood groups that could then impose their collective wills on elected representatives, as opposed to fielding their own candidates. Molney's excuse? There is not enough time. Hunter Thompson was enraged. Afterward, in an op-ed for the Aspen Illustrated News, he wrote that the CCA will wither into history as a bad joke unless they can muster a slate from their own ranks to run for mayor and city council. It wasn't enough anymore in this evil Nixon autumn to carry signs and stage sit-ins. To him, the Rulison demonstration was just another bad echo of the doomed protest tradition. He also didn't hesitate to call out the town's prominent developers and businessmen by name, labeling them greedy plastic bastards and cheap carny hustlers. He was willing to run for office himself, he added, but as a resident of Woody Creek, he was only eligible for county as opposed to city positions. "What we do need," he concluded in the op-ed, "is a decent-thinking candidate for mayor and a slate of potential councilmen he can work with." After the death of his daughter, Hunter Thompson wrote to Tom Wolfe, "I find myself watching the horizon and hoping to see flames." To William Kennedy, "Well, I said I would write, but I'm damned if I have the stomach for it. Everything that could possibly go wrong here has." To his maternal aunt in Louisville, with whom he'd always been close, "Thank you for the birthday present and the nice note to Sandy, which won't be answered, since I've told her to forget any references or replies to that situation. She appreciated your note, but under the circumstances, I think she'll be better off forgetting the whole thing." To Joe Benty, an anchor at CBS, whose newscast he'd found lacking, "You people are in fact a gang of cowardly, self-censoring swine. Your coverage of the Chicago DNC conspiracy trial is a cheap cop-out. Fuck this action. I have better things to do." To Jim Silberman, "My need for a focus is beyond critical. It borders on paralysis and desperation." Years later, Sandy would say, reflecting on that summer's tragedy, "I was with Hunter and another person, and I said something about losing my children. And Hunter looked at me, and very gently he said, 'Sandy, they were my children too.'" When they lost their daughter, the Thompsons had retreated to Owl Farm, situating themselves on the land they'd purchased in expectation of their new family member. But that September, after the CCA meeting, and seeing so clearly the environmental and political threats to their home, Hunter Thompson felt angry enough about the state of things to write the op-ed for the Aspen Illustrated News. It was published at the end of September. Suddenly, Thompson found himself, to his surprise, publicly and privately attacked by the rich developers he'd called out. They were far more outraged than he'd imagined possible. A few days later, he sat down with James Salter and Peggy Clifford to consider possible last-minute candidates for the mayoral race, which was now only a month away. The best option appeared to be a 29-year-old local attorney named Joe Edwards, who, the year before, had successfully challenged the city in district court over its discriminatory vagrancy policies. As an original member of the CCA, Edwards had also spoken out against overdevelopment. With his Clark Gable mustache and talent for motorcycle racing, he cut an alluring figure, someone the hippie crowd and the long-established liberal residents might rally around. On the spur of the moment, Thompson decided to give Edwards a call. The two had never met. It was after midnight and the conversation started awkwardly. Edwards, it soon became clear, had been asleep. "We need to straighten out this town," Thompson told him. "We need to organize all the bartenders and ski bums, the kids working the ski lifts and in the restaurants and bars. We have the numbers. If we can just get them registered and get them interested and get them to participate, we'll have the political power to change the town. Edwards was intrigued. Running for mayor, he finally said. Fuck it, why not? And like that, it was happening. With Thompson serving as the de facto campaign manager, and with the help of Clifford and Salter, and mutual friends like Tom Benton, Billy Noonan, and Michael Solheim, a local bartender and house painter, the Edwards campaign set off on a manic, month-long drive to convince enough residents that it was in their best interest to elect this young, anti-expansion, pro-environment candidate. Thompson devised a two-step plan of action. The first part focused on voter registration. Over the next 10 days, they worked to find and bring into the fray the hundreds of hippies who'd arrived in Aspen during the last few years, which wasn't easy. One of the reasons for fleeing to the Rockies in the first place was to try and escape what they perceived as the rigged nature of American life. Later, looking back on this phase of the campaign, Thompson would write, "Somewhere in the nightmare of failure that gripped America between 1965 and 1970, the old Berkeley-born notion of beating the system by fighting it gave way to a sort of numb conviction that it made more sense in the long run to flee, or even simply to hide, than to fight the bastards on anything even vaguely resembling their own terms." It was a consuming process into which Thompson threw himself. With the campaign, he could work from home and in town, close to his grieving, devastated wife, while also distracting himself with something besides the despair-heavy solitude that, after the death of his daughter, infused everything, including the writing process. From Owl Farm and other locations, they made phone calls, checked registries, and personally canvassed different districts of the city. There were perhaps 1,600 possible votes at stake, and with a three-person race, in addition to the town's pro-business candidate, a nondescript attorney named Leonard Oates, the Republicans were running a longtime party socialite, Eve Homeyer, who portrayed herself as embodying Aspen's platonic ideal of a den mother. A few late registrations could make all the difference. The second phase, beginning in mid-October, consisted of a multi-platform advertising campaign. Peggy Clifford crafted newspaper ads. Joe Edwards will work with residents and planners to develop a long-range plan for orderly growth and preservation of our resources, she wrote. They took out a series of radio spots. Tom Benton designed new silkscreen posters. Each featured a fist with two fingers raised in the peace sign. "If you don't give a damn, don't register to vote," some read. Others, "Sell Aspen or save it, there's still time." They all included the line at the bottom, "Joe Edwards for mayor." Edwards's platform had five parts. One, move all telephone and electrical utilities underground. Two, set aside mandatory green spaces. Three, reroute traffic from the city center and create a pedestrian mall in place of the busiest blocks of street. Four, enact an ordinance to preserve and update historic buildings. And five, hire an ecologist planner to estimate the valley's current resources and the extent of its overall capacity for growth. By November, the town's pro-business faction, identified by Thompson as the subdividers, ski pimps, and city-based land developers who had come like a plague of poison roaches to buy and sell the whole valley out from under the people who still valued it as a good place to live, not just a good investment, was nervous. For them, Aspen, with its rising lift ticket and restaurant and lodging prices, represented a king hell gold mine with no end in sight, the showpiece money hub of a gold rush that has made millionaires. And they weren't about to give up their political influence, and in turn, their profits, without a fight. By election day, the race appeared to be a toss-up. It would all depend on the November 4 turnout. At the polls that Tuesday, the two leaders of the pro-development faction opposing Edwards, the town's outgoing mayor, Dr. Robert Bugsy Barnard, and Guido Meyer, a maniacal, hippie-hating, Swiss-born resort owner, had threatened to challenge and disqualify the newly registered voters. So that morning, Thompson sent a group of poll watchers, led by Tom Benton, to the polling section at Ward 1, located at Crest House Lodge, which was owned and operated by Guido Meyer. Armed with a tape recorder and microphone and copies of the state election statutes, Bugsy Barnard arrived in his Porsche just after dawn. Guido came out to the parking lot to watch. But as the outgoing mayor pulled to a stop, the Edwards voters he'd come to challenge descended on him. "You're fucked, Bugsy," one of them yelled. Another, "Your whole act is doomed." Another, "We're going to beat your ass like a gong." Bugsy sprinted inside where Benton was waiting. "The reason I have this little black machine," he said to him, "is that I want to tape every word you say when you start committing felonies by harassing our voters." And when the two pro-business leaders tried to challenge one of the first voters, a kid who looked at most 18, the young man replied, "Go fuck yourself, Bugsy. You figure out how old I am. I know the goddamn law. I don't have to show you proof of anything." Which was how things would pretty much go all throughout the rest of the day. Just before the polls closed, the campaign double-checked its lists with notes from the poll watchers. They commandeered a bank of telephones to remind unaccounted-for supporters that it was their last chance to make a difference. It appeared as if they might actually win. The turnout had been much greater than expected. Bugsy and Guido's candidate, diminutive lawyer Lenny Oates, had been blown out of the water. The only question was whether Eve Hohmeyer, the Republican Party's self-proclaimed den mother, would draw enough support. It was 5 p.m. The voting was over. There was nothing more Thompson could do. The high-speed burn of the last month's effort was finally at an end. He was exhausted, surprised, bemused. Most of all, he was elated. "The campaign was a straight exercise in Jeffersonian democracy," he'd write. In the wake of Chicago, it had been imperative to get a grip on those who had somehow slipped into power and caused the thing to happen. And with the Edwards campaign, he'd come at them directly, at the cartel of local businessmen who instructed the cops to do whatever was necessary to protect the town's image. With someone like Richard Milhouse Nixon setting the general tone in Washington, regional crooks like Bugsy and Guido would only grow more powerful if left unchallenged. That night, the election turned into a toss-up. Eventually, it came down to absentee ballots. At last, it appeared that Joe Edwards had lost by 6 votes, a margin that, when all was said and done, would grow as slim as 1. The campaign staff talked about mounting a legal challenge, but it would have been too costly. Instead, they decided to try again the next November, when a new slate of key positions would be up for grabs. "What emerged from the Joe Edwards campaign," he'd write, "was a very real blueprint for stomping the Agnew mentality by its own rules, with the vote instead of the bomb. By seizing their power machinery and using it, instead of merely destroying it." He called it the Aspen technique, neither opting out of the system nor working within it, but calling its bluff, by using its strength to turn it back on itself, and by always assuming that the people in power are not smart. Afterward, faced again with the reality of his everyday life, its grief and demands, Hunter Thompson arranged for Juan to visit his grandmother in Florida, and he took Sandy to Los Angeles, where they enjoyed what he'd call a 10-year delayed honeymoon. They stayed in style at the Hyatt Continental, and at night with Oscar Acosta and his new wife Socorro Aganiga, a student at UCLA, they hit the town. During the day, they sat by the rooftop pool. The Thompsons were grieving together. At one point, they launched honeydew rinds from the 12th floor down at the cars on the Sunset Strip below, laughing and hiding as if they were decades younger. They got back to Aspen in early December with a maxed-out Diners Club card right around the time the Rolling Stones' Let It Bleed was released, an album that Hunter Thompson would remain particularly attached to for the rest of his life. On December 6, the Stones held a free concert at the Altamont Speedway, and as Mick Jagger belted out Under My Thumb, a drunken posse of Hell's Angels, serving as the venue's security force in exchange for free beer, stabbed to death 18-year-old Meredith Hunter at the base of the stage. It was an echo of what Thompson had seen 4 years earlier at the Oakland-Berkeley border, when the fledgling anti-war movement had been so naive as to think a group as fascistic as the Angels would join their cause. Now, on a familiar note of violence, the 1960s drew to a close. Not that Thompson was surprised. For him, the spirit of hope and change that had defined so much of the decade had been crushed more than a year earlier on the corner of Michigan and Balbo. This was just the final act. The orgy of violence at Altamont merely dramatized the problem. He'd write, "The realities were already fixed. The illness was understood to be terminal, and the energies of the movement were long since aggressively dissipated." Light Years. During the final week of April 1970, in the midst of a storm that pressed Aspen with a surprising late-season snow, Hunter and Sandy Thompson drove to dinner at the house of the writer James Salter and his wife Anne. An elegant meal, continental in style. They sat together for hours. Salter had been coming to Aspen since 1959. Like the Thompsons, he knew the town before its recent transition into a resort. His two-bedroom house was located on the West End, near the Meadows. Salter preferred to spend time with Thompson in these sorts of settings, private and contained, uncrowded, somewhere they could talk without distraction. A couple's dinner was ideal. In the cozy dining room, these two very different men were able to enjoy one another's company. They'd become friends the previous fall, working together on the Edwards campaign. After the meal was done, they sat together in front of the living room fire. They talked about writing. Eventually, Thompson went into his struggles. His The Death of the American Dream book was long overdue, but he had to finish it. There was no